So it's great to be back here. 17 years ago, right? Something like that, guys? Lee? The black hole. 17 years, yeah. Which, you know, actually this whole thing would have not happened if I would have taken a job at PI as a postdoc. And now I end up doing all this crazy stuff. So,
in other words, Stefan is saying he was one of our first offers and he turned us down. Yeah.
Well, I didn't turn you guys down. You guys turned me down. So.
You turned us down to go to Stanford.
Well, that's where the story begins. So first of all, I had some technical problems. For some reason, I bought a faster Macintosh. You know, the new Macs, they screw you over because you have to now use a new cord. But the computers are slower. So it froze on me while I was trying to make the titles. I used to make the titles last. So I don't have a title slide, so that's why I'm doing it here. But the most important thing is I want to acknowledge my collaborators. My graduate student who just finished up did some very impressive numerical work that I certainly couldn't do. Sorry, Robert. it's really scary when your PhD advisor is like, you know, from a long time ago, is like here watching over you still. And my new collaborator, Brown David Lowe, who I guess is slowly becoming a cosmologist, if I have any luck. And my other graduates, my current graduate student, Robert Sims. And my collaborator from Dartmouth, Marcelo Gleiser. So this is based on two papers. And so I want to kind of begin my talk with discuss the fine-tuning problem. So, you know, we're trying to answer big questions here in cosmology, whether or not the universe can overcome, you know, the Big Bang and all this stuff, right? But at the end of the day, our universe has to speak to particle physics, right? It has to speak to the standard model. And we expect it to speak to the standard model in non-trivial ways. For example, baryogenesis is a perfect example of this, right? Where you need input from both cosmology and particle physics to explain why there's a baryon asymmetry in the universe, right? And there's some interesting connections between cosmological observables like the baryon asymmetry index and omega baryon, right? So the fact that we can infer omega baryon from the CMB and the baryon asymmetry index from nucleosynthesis, for example, are very non-trivial ways that particle physics is connected to cosmology. Well, my job depends on it. That's why I'm trying to make that case, right? That's what I do. I work at the interface of particle physics and cosmology. Now, the fine-tuning problem is the basic statement that our standard model Lagrangian, right, roughly has 18 to 19 coupling constants. In the gauge sectors, for example, like we have the SU3, SU2 cross U1, right, all the gauge content there, the gauge fields, are Yang-Mills-like theories, and those things have coupling constants that are not specified by the dynamics of the theory itself, right? Those coupling constants are put in there as input. So we could just say, you know, let's live with that, right? Or we could try to understand why the coupling constants are the way they are measured to be. Now you could say, well, why do we care? Well, if you care about how carbon is produced in stars, we know that, you know, the triple alpha process of how carbon is produced by star cooling, star burning, is highly sensitive, right, to the ratios of the electroweak and the strong interaction. I forget how sensitive. But I hear that it's something, if you mess with this ratio, within a few percent, you don't produce carbon, right? So these arguments as to why the coupling constants in our standard model are the way they are cannot be answered by the theory itself. So that's one way to approach this problem. Another way to approach the problem is we look at our theories from which the standard model arises. For example, I'm not biased, I've worked on both, lots of different approaches of quantum gravity, but when I entered my second postdoc at Stanford, this was a problem that people were thinking about, okay? This was the year 2002. And the context in which they were studying this was in the context where you had some control of studying low energy compactification. So I just want to give you a sort of slide that to kind of give you a sense of how that all worked. How the coupling constants in the four-dimensional standard model realization in some specific cases of string theory, and the case of string theory that I'm going to focus on here is the heterotic string theory, because that theory is intrinsically chiral, meaning that you get chiral matter, right, in four dimensions. And the way you can see this happen is if you look at the 10-dimensional alpha prime corrected supergravity approximation of string theory. So you pick up, you basically have the Einstein curvature tensor, you have the dilaton field, the 10-dimensional dilaton field, you have this anti-symmetric 3 form and your spinners, okay, and the gauge fields that actually become your Yang-Mills theory. And if you compactify, meaning you split your metric up into a 4-dimensional part and a 6-dimensional piece, which you have to argue why it's so small and unobservable, what you basically find after some shuffling around is that you can basically hide all of your 6-dimensional stuff because they become very tiny, meaning that the mass scales of those theory is very high, and that effective theory becomes irrelevant. And you end up with an effective theory. Again, I'm waving my hands here because there are some issues with your 4-dimensional Einstein and some scalar content. And you have basically your Yang-Mills theory with your Yang-Mills coupling. But of course, you have many other fields in this theory that I'm ignoring. These other fields that I'm ignoring are called moduli field. And the moduli field have to do with the fact that in these 6 dimensions, these extra 6 dimensions here, depending on how I deform that geometry, all right, the deformation of that geometry depends on fields. And these fields come with potentials. And these potentials are supposed to stabilize these fields. But generically, they do not. All right, so they're all, Robert has worked on some of this stuff with his students of ways to stabilize these moduli, these fields, right? But in general, they're not stabilized. And you have, if you, 10 to the 500 of these fields, and this is, the upshot of this is, string theory does provide you, or can provide you, with ways of understanding that the coupling constants are none other than dynamical fields, which can evolve to find the values that we hope are the values that we see today. But there are many other possible values that they can undertake. And so the question is, how do you reconcile this with cosmology? Now, this is what we call the landscape problem, meaning that there is this huge landscape in field space of possible values that the coupling constants could undertake. And the question is, why do we live in it? Why does our universe have the value that it has? So I'm now formulating this problem in the context of a theory that gives you many possibilities for the coupling constants. So what you do is you become a postdoc at that place, and you have two people fighting with each other for weeks on end. This is, my mentors, Lenny Susskind and Andre Linde. They were going at it during this time when I was a postdoc. And one day, Lenny goes, I got it, I solved the problem. And he writes a paper called A String Landscape. And then I go to him and I say, Lenny, what should we do? We were hired to try to figure out how to solve this problem, and now you basically said this. He goes, that's okay, just be lucky that you're living in one of these guys here, right? Okay, so the basic idea there is that you basically take the picture of eternal inflation, which was Andre's thing, that Andre was fighting about that piece, and Lenny was basically saying there's this landscape. And if you combine these two things and you say, hey, if I start proliferating my universe with all these basically inflating bubbles, all right, these false vacuum regions basically start percolating new bubbles, right? Then I can populate, by some mechanism that I guess Lenny understands well. all right, I can populate. Hey, Lenny, we love you.
We love your theory too much.
That's us right there. Right, that's us right there. So the idea is that these couplings basically can take on random values, and we just happen to be hit the jackpot. Okay? That's what you call cosmic karma at its best. Okay, so that's the basic idea there. So, you know, right around this time, I forget what year did you guys do the cyclic model? I think it was 2002. Ah, look at that. This paper came on the scene. And I paid no attention to it.
My name got changed to Trump.
Oh my God, that is such a typo. I kid you. That is meant to be Turok, okay? As in, that's.
I'm gonna change my name.
That is a complete typo. Okay. All right, so the basic idea there is that, you know, and I actually stole this picture from your paper, okay? That basically, you have these different stages of how this field evolves from an expansion phase, then to a contraction phase, and it basically cycles back and forth, all right? That's the basic idea of the cyclic universe. I thought it was fit to talk about cyclic universes because you actually need to have bounces to have a cyclic universe. So the idea here is to see whether or not we can actually address a fine-tuning problem with cyclic universes. That's the idea. So let me first of all give you a full disclosure. What I'm going to present here is an idea first and foremost, meaning that it's this idea more or less works pretty well, but it has some caveats. So it's presented as a toy model, but I really want you to go away with the idea and that this model seems to actually incorporate quite naturally a resolution of the fine-tuning problem. And I think that's really cool because when you guys came up with this thing, it wasn't like you were thinking, hey, let's address the fine-tuning problem, but it seemed to find a natural home for the fine-tuning problem, okay? So what I'm gonna do is take some wisdom from string theory, right? But again, this theory could come from anywhere. I just took some ideas from string theory, but this is not embedded in string theory. The theory I'm gonna talk about is, and I guess Neil, you should be happy with this because it's very similar, right, to having your bounce theory that is conformally coupled, except the coupling now is in a gauge sector, all right? But it'll be interesting to see if you can carry this through actually with your theory as well. So the basic idea here is the following. What you have is Einstein-Hilbert, a scalar field. It's a real scalar field. The scalar field has a very particular potential. And this field is a ghost. So, meaning it has a negative kinetic energy term, but it has a very peculiar potential in that the potential is also negative. And what that means for dynamics is, I love these boards, is that if you look at, you know, in ordinary Newtonian mechanics, something is at the top of a potential, meaning you have opposite signs and potential and kinetic, is that you let the thing, it'll just fall down. In this case, if I start the ball up at the bottom, it actually finds home at the top. It stabilized at the top. If both the potential and the kinetic energy is negative, that's going to be important for the dynamics, the cosmological dynamics here, okay? So here's an upshot here. The upshot is that we sum over I of all these gauge fields, and this will sum over the SU3 component of Yang-Mills, SU2, and the U1, all right? So I runs over all those indices. So in a case, we can think of these scalar fields and notice that, just want to make sure that I have that here. All right. What I should tell you is that G Yang-Mills is proportional to e to the minus phi. All right? So it looks something similar to a dilaton field. All right? So this, sorry. Over some mass called m star, which will be set by some observational constraint. All right? So notice if this field evolves, right? Then the coupling constants of the Yang-Mills theory could change. All right, so that's the idea. Now we're going to put this in a cyclic universe type of setting. The other thing that's important here is that this potential is oscillatory. Now, when you guys try to address the cosmological constant problem, with cyclic cosmologies, you also use a very similar potential with a linear term, right? The washboard potential. So that's an interesting note to make there, right? Yes?
Next eyes overall, that you just have one psi field.
That's right. So what I'm going to do is demonstrate it for one field, and that generic behavior we'll see will be generalized.
So then in that case, you'd have as many psi fields as you have
gauge couplings. That's right. And we're going to focus on one gauge coupling. And what you'll see, when you it'll become clear that it'll be easy to carry it over for the other gauge sectors. Okay, so let's move on. Now let's look at the equations of motion. So we first have the equation, we're working in conformal coordinates here. So this is with respect to conformal time. So we have your usual Friedman equation of motion for this, for your coupling field, let me call it your coupling field. You have your usual Friedman equation, which becomes this here. And notice, right, as you would expect a bounce when h goes to zero in time. And what's really driving that are basically these two terms. Let's actually look at the case where this term actually becomes insignificant, and you can imagine there's going to be some phase where this potential is minimized, right? And if that's the case, what you find, you can get an exact solution. And that solution shows that phi prime has this solution. It redshifts in this way. And the scale factor is exactly oscillatory, mimicking basically the cyclic behavior. All right? Now, if you go on the computer, what we find is actually this persists. All right?
Sorry, I missed it. What causes the bounce gap? Do you have curvature here?
What causes the bounce is actually this term here.
I have a ghost.
Yeah,
okay.
The ghost term. Right, because this is square, so this goes as right, a to the fourth.
You have spatial curvature as well.
Thank you. You need spatial curvature to make this happen. If you look actually at the square root here, it depends on the spatial curvature so that this thing becomes a sine rather than a sinh. Okay. Okay. If you go on a computer now and you calculate, this is very interesting, so I want us to actually pay attention to this. This is probably the most important slide here. And this is all the great work of my graduate student, Sam Cormack. I have no responsibility for it, and so I have to. I just said, go ahead and do this.
No, no credit either.
Yes. Wait, I get no credit.
All the responsibility and no credit.
Yes, all responsibility and no credit. Thank you. Right. So, two interesting things to, you can imagine a situation where this field evolves, and as it goes towards the bounce, the kinetic energy basically increases, right? As the kinetic sort of, as the universe contracts, kinetic energy increases, and it just blows up, right? Because unless I bounce. But it's the kinetic energy that's actually creating the bounce, all right? So that's one interesting thing to observe. The question is, what happens to the field during the bounce? What this shows, actually, what we're looking at here is phi, the magnitude of phi, as a function of cosmic time. And each step from 1 to 2 corresponds to going through a bounce. So notice, as you go through one step, actually, you find that as the field goes through a bounce, the amplitude changes by 1 unit, or sometimes it changes by 2 units. And then during the expansion, which is actually between bounces, it completely freezes. So, you know, when I was a young kid of cosmology, Robert's student, I don't know, 20 years ago, I was always scared to ask Robert the following question because I thought he would think I was stupid, right? Well, he probably did anyway, but. So. The question I wanted to ask Robert was, why the hell do I care that the universe is expanding? But what does it do for us? You know, what does it do for us? You know, that it's expanding. I mean, because I have to explain this to kids, right? You know, I talked to a bunch of kids at an elementary school about the expanding. They were like, we don't care. But actually, finally, I got a satisfying thing, because if indeed coupling constants were really allowed to vary now, It's Hubble friction that's freezing the coupling. Let's go back, actually, to this equation here. You'll see it. You see? The Hubble friction is, in fact, a damping term. And as the universe expands, what happens is that during the bounce, kinetic energy is high, right? Some interesting thing happens that I'll get into that causes the field to evolve rapidly during and only during the bounce. As the universe expands, the Hubble friction freezes it. The question is, does it freeze it enough? To answer that question, there's one parameter in the theory. And that parameter is a decay constant, this F. All right? How this thing evolves during the bounce very much depends on this value F, all right? And that's going to be important. So let me just get back. During a bounce, notice that the field actually oscillates. I'm blowing up a region here, so it generically does that. Now the question is, to really solve a fine-tuning problem, you need a very old universe, and you need this thing to be very random. The question is it? So we found a measure, thanks to my colleague Marcelo Gleiser, he says hi, by the way, to all the old timers. So what we can do is define an order correlation function of the differences, meaning that we compare the field as it changes across a bounce, and we define an order correlation function. And what we do is we compare it. So dot is actually this thing as I go through a sample through many bounces. And I compare it to a random distribution, a random order correlation function. And what you find is that if you tune this F to be a very specific number, I'll tell you in a second, you find that here are some cases where it's indistinguishable from a random distribution. So what happens, the picture what we have here, universe contracts, okay? This field basically rapidly, you know, drives into the bounce, it drives the bounce itself, it randomizes its value It has one coupling constant in one universe. When it gets to another universe, it has another random coupling constant, right? And then it stabilizes. Okay, how does it stabilize? That's actually wrong. It stabilizes because, remember, this G Yang Mills is e to the phi over m. So this delta change in phi, right, is related to delta of the Yang Mills relative to its original value is delta of psi. Right? And it turns out that this parameter F basically is a thing that's setting the variation of phi away from the bounce. Okay, so that's important. Well, if we use the observations of Webb et al., they basically put down this limit on the variation of the fine structure constant to be roughly 10 to the minus 5. That immediately puts a limit on F. Yes?
F has to be bigger than that?
Yes. Yes.
If I read that delta alpha over alpha, that's not a limit, that's a measurement.
It's a measurement, that's right. You're completely right. It's not a limit, it's a measurement.
But you want to call a limit to be safe.
To be conservative. So anyway, the important thing here is that, look, I mean, the thing that's, we were scared before we calculated the number because we were like, it's going to fall into some unobservable like range or some super Planckian thing, and the theory would be completely inconsistent. But this is gut scale, which is exactly where we like the axion to be, right? So that's kind of interesting that in this value, in this regime, it works. It turns out that this value also is a value that is consistent with the random distribution. So these dots here are basically the autocorrelation function for larger values of F, okay? That doesn't actually meet this bound. So we have these two conditions, right? One condition is a theoretical condition, well, observational, because we want to solve the fine-tuning problem for a very old cyclic universe, right? We're saying that the universe is so old that we happen to be in the phase where the universe is taking on these random values. But it's one universe. That's a good thing here, right? But at the same time, we want, for that coupling constant in the theory, we want basically the variation of the coupling constant to be stabilized in our expanding phase.
So yeah. The contracting phase then is going to be the way, right? Because the yeah. Double friction would actually
that's right.
Friction. And
that's
so,
right.
So then the coupling constants are changing very rapidly.
That's right. That's right. So we don't want to be living in a...
So your theory doesn't have a shift, doesn't have a discrete shift symmetry. It doesn't at all.
It does not.
The Lagrange on its own does, but the gauge couplings do not.
That's right.
And what's to stop the scalar field from zooming off to plus infinity or minus infinity? You can do it in your potential. You can still do it. So it has an unbounded...
I'll answer that with the stability analysis. Stability analysis. So that's right. So let's look at the stability analysis. So first of all, we want to look at the stability analysis of the background field. So we take the equation of motion, we go to phase space, and we look for limit cycles. So this was David Lowe's idea. So the idea here is that basically, here's a phase portrait of the scale factor, in this case, right? And we for different values of f. And what we find basically is that it's bounded, number one. But if you look at the Gauss field, you also have bounded orbits as well, all right? So that it doesn't run away. The background field doesn't run away. All right.
But you've got no potential stopping it from running away.
No, you have a potential, the cosine potential.
Yeah, but it's flat, large. I mean, I can go from one maximum to another, to another, to another, off to infinity.
I think that's what you're seeing here. So this is phi and phi dot. So what happens is that you have these bands where it's like stable, but if you give it enough kinetic energy, it could jump to the other band and it's stable. Okay. So that's what you're seeing.
But at a very long time, maybe it's
very at a very long time, but by then maybe the universe would have contracted. I don't know. It's a good question though. Analysis of Bardeen variables, the scalar perturbation. And in this case, notice that if we perturb the Gauss field, the Gauss coupling field, and the metric, of course, we're going to work where this is minus this. What you find is that you can basically disentangle this, and this becomes an equation for the metric perturbation and the Gauss. And notice that they source each other, right? Well, this one completely is disentangled. But notice that you have a source for the Gauss field, that the metric perturbation will be coupled to that. Okay? So I'm leaving because I know Robert's staring at it to make sure that the algebra is right. David caught a sine error. So, so what we're looking at are two cases of where we have a super horizon mode and a horizon mode. We can know that by we plot the Hubble parameter during the bounce, right? In these units, which is the energy density of the Gauss field divided by the Planck scale. And if you could compare this to basically show that this is basically the sub-horizon modes during, as you go through the bounce into expansion phase. So this is as a function of conformal time, and that's the amplitude of the perturbations relative to the initial amplitude of the bounce. And you find that it's oscillatory, and at later time, it does die on you. It does diverge. But for a good range in the expansion history, it actually is oscillatory. Super horizon modes are, as to be expected, divergent. Okay? And this is basically the oscillatory behavior of the perturbations of the Gauss field itself. Okay, so that's basically that statement in word that the perturbations that enter the horizon early are stable throughout the expansion and the contraction, and the perturbation that enter the horizon later are unstable. are unstable throughout the expansion and contraction. What about quantum stability? This is our Achilles heel. There are two channels for quantum instability. One is because this thing couples to the gauge field, in this case, look at a photon, a graviton basically could actually, this can basically, through a graviton mediation, decay into photons, okay? And we can have basically that the photon, that this Gauss field can actually decay into photons. Okay, so you can actually show that this leads to MeV scale cutoff, ultraviolet cutoff. If you take this perturbative vacuum issue seriously. But as you guys know, there people have been working very hard on this. People like Okani Hamed, what's our friend in Munich? Diwali is working on this, the whole classicalon mechanism. So their idea is that basically you're expanding around the wrong vacuum. And one example of this is a Gauss condensate, where basically your dispersion relations are now nonlinear. And so because they're nonlinear, basically, it's like the Higgs mechanism, right? You never expand the Higgs field, right? Around the tachyonic part of its vacuum. You never take a linear mode of the Higgs field here, right? You take it down here. And because the dispersion relations are bounded, right? Likewise here, if you think of del phi as a new field variable, you end up having something like a Mexican hat potential for the Gauss field. And so that's potentially one way out of this problem, but it's something that me and David Lowe and my student are currently working on. So that's a way of worming myself out of the issue. The answer is it could be a problem, and there might be ways around it. So to conclude, because now people are getting hungry, cyclic bouncing cosmologies can be useful for addressing the fine tune of gauge couplings in the standard model. This can also be done with Yukawa couplings, by the way. Just promote your coupling constant, your Yukawa couplings, to a dynamical field. The toy theory presently relies on a Gauss moduli fields, which are randomized during the bounce. The couplings get stabilized due to Hubble friction, which is a nice feature, nice dynamical feature that we weren't expecting. A stability analysis showed that the system is classically stable. We're currently investigating the issue of quantum stability. And I think a more realistic setting, this is Robert's idea. You see, because you're relying on this Gauss field, you're relying on this very negative equation of state. But in ekpyrotic scenarios, or even in LQ loop quantum cosmology settings, you have situations where you could have a stiff equation of state, and you won't have this Gauss instability, quantum instability issue. So it could be a more realistic setting, maybe the ekpyrotic setting, which uses a stiff equation of state. So that's pretty much my talk. Thank you.
If you now think about extending this to several fields or more couplings, right, it gets harder and harder to find simultaneously the right values everywhere, isn't it?
The universe has just to be infinitely much larger and older. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's I get that either we have to live with this idea that, hey, there are just some things we can never know about, you know, all the theories of our world, or we have so far these two mechanisms that does it. I mean, I wasn't actually interested in the stuff that you guys are working on currently, because I wonder if, like, you know, you have your two, you know, you have your, you know, universe bouncing in this quantum mechanical way. It could be that the universe does it much faster or something. I don't know.
Because you have to make a lot of space before you get the right conditions. It seems like a waste.
It's not a waste. I mean, according to this, I mean, this is a philosophical issue. I mean, like, you know, if the universe really is cyclic.
Then you might worry but then there might be another mechanism which does it more efficiently.
That's right. That's a good point. Right. So again, this is just, right, as far as I'm thinking, it's an idea, but I think that it seems to be more satisfactory for me than the bubble universes that occupy whatever, and we live in a bubble kind of thing.
That's even more waste.
Yeah, right. At least I have equations here.
Right.
Yes, please.
I missed one point. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful story. But in the end, the parameters are fine-tuned for what?
Say it again?
The parameters are fine-tuned for what?
That's your job.
Okay, tomorrow.
Yeah, that's a good question.
Okay, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
be the only person in the room to defend the multiverse.
I noticed that there's a culprit in the room. A man living in his own bubble. Two bubbles collide.
It's colliding with yours right now. So I mean, it's basically the same argument, except for instead of wasting space, as Jean-Luc would have, you're going to waste a lot of time. So why do we live now? Why now?
I can answer that question. But that answer is very personal, okay?
That's the same as my question.
I mean, that's a real question, though, right?
Are you trying to say that I'm a holographic projection of like your mouth?
His answer was it's a personal.
I will address it tomorrow.
Okay. You have a question?
I have another one. The classical stability seems to indicate that, you know, sooner or later the field will diverge. And I guess, but you need a lot of time until you get all the right couplings. So can you arrange it such that you have enough time before?
Yes, I believe you can do that, yes. But we haven't done that, but I believe you can.
Yeah. In the beginning, you started with this action in 10 dimensions, and then you find it.
Mm-hmm.
Then you started talking about this particular psi field,
mm-hmm.
and some modern action. But in the original action, you also had some spinner fields.
Yes.
And this action, there didn't seem to be any spinner
no
fields.
No spinner fields.
So therefore, this action, does it come from there, or is
no,
it?
No, it has nothing to do with it. I just use that to basically state what the problem is in some people's mind of what the sine tuning problem is, from the perspective of string theory.
Okay, so therefore, this action is just invented here at the moment from the side.
And as far as we're concerned, we can just take our standard model, couple to general relativity, right? And then promote those fields, those couplings to fields, and then we're done according to this. Yes.
And the random walk in the high dimensions doesn't necessarily come back in time. So can you say anything about the probability that you will end up with a universe with our coupling constant?
That's a great question. I think it's something that can be computed. Because we have the autocorrelation function, right? We have the dynamics, and I think that's something one could compute. Yeah. You want to do it?
Okay. Unless there are more urgent questions.
Just one last comment that would then depend, because the probability of return would also depend on the coupling constants themselves. Because in a given, so if you're starting off with something very arbitrary starting
mm-hmm.
point, then that will be a concern whether you will move towards a situation where such things will occur more often. The first one could occur in a much longer time than.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think that one thing you can imagine starting to do is to maybe condition, add some extra conditions, that basically put these coupling constants in some kind of attractive. So for example, like the CKM matrix, for I think neutrino masses, definitely, there's some patterns there. And, you know, like A4 symmetry and things like that. So it could be that one might be able to, in fact, we were thinking in context of loop quantum gravity because you have tetrahedra. Me and Antonino, we were thinking a long time ago of like using that type of stuff, right? And discretizing the standard model on that to see if you can get some kind of, get the coupling constants to kind of be attracted, you know, to that. So it raises these kind of interesting questions. So good point.
Okay. So thanks for calling again.